Blackstone Audio presents Beckett in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Introduction. In 1946, Beckett found himself back in Ireland, staying with his disapproving mother. He had left Paris because he did not have enough money to continue living in his chosen city. He was now approaching 40, and forced to confront the prospect of his utter failure. All the hopes of his brilliant youth had come to nothing. Apart from a few scattered pieces, mostly in small magazines, he had published just one novel. This had passed virtually unnoticed by the reading public, the bulk of its copies being remaindered. During the war he had written another novel, and had at last felt that he was getting somewhere. But this novel had recently been turned down by his publishers, who had reacted to it with considerable bewilderment, finding it wild and unintelligible. In their opinion, it stood no chance whatsoever of publication. Though deeply wounded by this rejection, Beckett, too, was dissatisfied with his work. He disagreed with his publisher's rejection, but he felt a nagging suspicion that he was somehow not on the right track. Something was missing. Something eluded him, preventing him from achieving all of which he felt he was capable. The great promise he had shown, the promise that had been recognized by no less than James Joyce himself, remained unfulfilled. Beckett was at a loss over what to do, and he began drinking heavily in the bars of Dublin. At night he would wander the streets in a bemused state, lost in his thoughts. One night he found himself standing at the end of the stone pier of Dunleary Harbour. Years later he would recall this moment in an early version of his play Crap's Last Tape, where Crap's recorded voice disjointedly relates, "Intellectually, a year of profound gloom and indigence until that memorable night in March, at the end of the pier, in the howling wind, never to be forgotten, when suddenly I saw the whole thing, the turning point at last. This, I imagine, is what I have chiefly to set down this evening against the day when my work will be done, and perhaps no place left in my memory, and no thankfulness for the miracle that, for the fire it set alight. What I saw then was that the assumption I had been going on all my life, namely, clear to me at last that the dark I have been fighting off all this time is in reality my most unshatterable association till my dying day of story and night with a light of understanding and—" Beckett had realized that he had been looking in the wrong place, in the wrong direction. Instead of trying to come to terms with the world around him, he should have been focusing on the inner world, on the dark he had struggled to keep under. Joyce had gone as far as it was possible to go, in the direction of knowing more, being in control of one's material. But Beckett realized that my own way was in impoverishment, in lack of knowledge, and in taking away, in subtracting rather than adding. His subject matter was not the great intellectual achievements of the human condition, but its hopelessness and despair, the grim, farcical element of its inescapable failure, all the things that he himself knew so well. From this point on, Beckett would no longer care whether what he wrote appeared wild and unintelligible. He would express the discontentedness of his own inner voice, the voice that had accompanied him through the long voyage of his life so far. Beckett's Life and Works. Samuel Beckett was born on Good Friday, April 13, 1906, in Foxrock, a middle-class suburb between the Wicklow Mountains and the Irish Sea south of Dublin. His family was descended from Huguenots, the Protestants who were forced to flee Catholic persecution in France during the late 18th century. But the Becketts had long since lost any awareness of themselves as anything other than Irish. The family was part of the prosperous Protestant minority in Ireland, which at the time was still part of Great Britain. There is little evidence of creative inclination among Beckett's predecessors, with the possible exception of his paternal grandmother Fanny, whose unfulfilled sensitivity drove her to drink. According to family mythology, she would lock herself in her room for days on end. At other times, she sported a parrot on her shoulder, which would screech with jealous rage when anyone kissed Fanny. William Beckett, the writer's father, was a jovial Philistine who made a considerable fortune as a building contractor and property speculator. Beckett retained affectionate memories of his father, with whom he would go on long walks over the barren, treeless countryside of the nearby Wicklow Mountains. But the dominant parent in Beckett's life was his mother, May, a tall, long-faced, difficult woman descended from an impecunious landowning family. All who met her agree that there was something odd about her, something that didn't quite fit in with the role of conventional suburban life. She suffered from insomnia, and had the carpets removed from the upstairs floors so that she could hear the footfall of any approaching ghost. Despite this, there was little overtly eccentric about her apart from her wilfulness. This appears to have met its match in her second son, Samuel. Beckett's older brother Frank took after his father, but it soon became clear that Sam was psychologically much more complex, a condition he appeared to find as irksome as everyone else. As a result, he was a solitary child, both by circumstance and inclination. Surprisingly, the reserved young Beckett did well at school, being both intellectually gifted and accomplished at sports, despite his bad eyesight. From an early age he had been forced to wear round, steel-rimmed spectacles, which he would continue to wear all his life. In 1920, at the age of 14, he became a boarder at Portora Royal School, a Protestant private school in the province of Ulster, which was to become Northern Ireland. In 1922, Ireland gained independence, with Northern Ireland electing to remain part of Britain. There followed a civil war in the Irish Free State between the two Catholic factions. The schoolboy Beckett would have been largely insulated from all this, but would certainly have been aware of the upheavals that were taking place. It is difficult to judge the precise effect of this traumatic historical background. It would certainly leave a profound mark upon his Protestant Irish contemporary, the painter Francis Bacon. The newly independent Ireland was a troubled, desperately poor country, heavily dominated by the Catholic Church, which forbade contraception. As a result, large families contributed further to the poverty of the majority Catholic population. Out of ambition or necessity, many emigrated to Britain and America, leaving saddened, abandoned families behind. Although Beckett never lived in poverty in his homeland, the hopeless, downtrodden characters who inhabit much of his later fiction would have been recognisable on any street in Dublin, even if the background Beckett gave them was often more reminiscent of the Wicklow Mountains. Beckett's unaccommodated man may have had a distant literary ancestor in the poor, bare, forked animal seen by Shakespeare's King Lear on the blasted heath. But the characters in Beckett's work also mirrored real people, whose hopeless temperament and grim humour had been forged by real despair. At the age of 17, Beckett went to Trinity College, Dublin, where he studied modern languages, English, French, and Italian. Here he quickly acquired the seemingly obligatory penchant for vast quantities of Guinness and an equally unquenchable thirst for literature and philosophy. In his final fourth year, he won a place on the university cricket team, which went on a short summer tour playing against English counties. These matches are recorded in Wisden, the cricketer's Bible, making him the only Nobel Prize winner to appear in its august pages. In his final exams, Beckett won the gold medal as the top scholar. He emerged from university an awkward young man who, in that scornful but telling Dublin phrase, was educated beyond his intelligence. Like his philosophical hero Descartes, he found it difficult to rise from his bed before noon. This made him particularly unsuited to the employment he now gained as a schoolmaster at Campbell College, Belfast, a middle-class Ulster institution similar to Portora. As with many a brilliant student, he quickly acquired a distaste for the amiable dullards who formed the staff and pupils. To them he appeared a conceited and arrogant young man. The final straw came when he was summoned yet again to appear before the exasperated headmaster, who forcefully reminded him that the pupils he treated with such contempt were, in fact, the cream of Ulster. "Yes," replied Beckett, "rich and thick." He found himself on the next train to Dublin. The only surprise was that he had lasted as long as 2 terms. Fortunately, his linguistic success at Trinity College enabled him to qualify for an exchange post as lecteur at the prestigious French École Normale Supérieure. This would allow him to live for 2 years in Paris. Nothing could have suited Beckett better. Within months he had taken up residence in a small room on the left bank, and was wearing a beret, his fingers browned with nicotine stains from strong Gaulois tobacco, drinking copious amounts of cheap red wine in the bars of the Latin Quarter. Although he duly carried out his light tutorial duties at the École, he appears to have mixed little with the students, among whom he might have encountered Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, who are currently the top philosophy students. Instead, Beckett met James Joyce, who had published Ulysses just 6 years earlier, and already had a reputation in some circles as Ireland's finest modern writer. The brilliant and impressionable young Beckett was overwhelmed by the brilliant and manipulative Joyce, who soon had Beckett running errands and doing secretarial chores. In 1929, Beckett contributed an essay to a book celebrating Joyce's work, and embarked upon a translation into French of a section from Finnegan's Wake, Joyce's work in progress. Beckett even assisted Joyce in the composition of this difficult modernistic work, taking down the author's words as he dictated. This task would result in a characteristic episode. On one occasion, when Beckett read back to Joyce the passage he had just dictated, the flow of densely elusive Joycean prose was found to include the words, "Come in," which Joyce could not remember saying. After some puzzled discussion, Joyce recalled that at one point someone had knocked on the door, and he must have replied, "Come in." This amused Joyce so much that he decided to leave Beckett's copy intact. Such accidents fell easily into the prose of Finnegan's Wake. "Not a sound falling. Lispen. No wind, no word. Only a leaf, just a leaf and the leaves. The woods are fond always. As were we their babes in. And robins in crews so. It is for me gould and wending. Unless? Away. Rise up, man of the hoofs. You have slept so long. Or is it only so, misleams?" At the time, this was the pinnacle of modernistic prose. The young, over-intellectual Beckett was entranced by its richness of literary allusion. Here was something he could not fail to admire, something that perhaps one day he might seek to emulate. Despite his shyness, Beckett was by now an attractive young man. Joyce's emotionally unstable daughter, Lucia, soon fell in love with the tall, taciturn figure who regularly called at the Joyce apartment. Beckett did his best to discourage her, but this disturbing episode appears to have contributed to her eventual mental collapse some years later. It also resulted in a brief estrangement with Joyce, though his influence on Beckett's way of thinking remained as strong as ever. Beckett now had ambitions to become a writer, and began composing poetry. It was highly allusive in the Joycean manner, with obscure references to all manner of writers in various languages. In 1930, the shipping heiress Nancy Cunard sponsored a prize for a poem of less than 100 lines on the subject of time. Beckett heard of this prize only on the evening before the deadline for entries, whereupon he stayed up till 3 a.m. writing a poem called Horoscope, based very obliquely on the life of Descartes. It opens, "What's that? An egg? By the brother's boot, it stinks fresh. Give it to Gio." The pages of notes at the end of the poem explain how Descartes liked his omelette made from eggs hatched from 8 to 10 days, that in 1640 the brother's boot refuted Aristotle in Dublin, and how Descartes passed on the easier problems in analytical geometry to his valet, Gio. Horoscope goes on like this for 98 lines, stuffed with reference yet empty of coherence, meaningful to the point of meaninglessness. This combination of conceit, erudition, obscurity, and fashionable modernity won Nancy Cunard's prize, and was duly published in book form by her Hours Press. Despite this minor success, Beckett remained a distinctly solitary individual, beset by an increasingly profound psychological bewilderment, resulting in bouts of depression and deep suffering. It was around this time that he discovered the misanthropic 19th-century German philosopher Schopenhauer, whose works are imbued with a deep pessimism. According to Schopenhauer, the world is merely representation, an illusory veil of Maya, sustained by an evil will. Beckett found himself drawn to what he called Schopenhauer's intellectual justification of unhappiness. Spiritual suffering was the lot of humanity. It should be accepted as such, not dismissed as some kind of psychological failing. Later, Beckett would write that the experience of discovering Schopenhauer was like suddenly a window opened in a fog. By 1930, Beckett's time as a lecteur at the École Normale Supérieure was over, and he was forced to return to Dublin. Here he reluctantly took a post as a lecturer at his alma mater, Trinity College. By now friends had brought Beckett to the attention of a London publisher who had commissioned him to write another work on time. This was to be a critical monologue on Proust, the author of the vast 7-volume novel Remembrance of Things Past. Beckett's monograph is pervaded by Schopenhauerian gloom. There is no escape from yesterday, because yesterday has deformed us, or been deformed by us. Yet amidst his displays of erudition and his attempts to come to terms with the great French writer, Beckett manages to focus his language into a number of pithy epigrams. Reality, whether approached imaginatively or empirically, remains a surface hermetic. For Proust, as for the painter, style is more a question of vision than of technique. More pertinently, if more obliquely, Proust also evolved into an attempt by Beckett to set down his own ideas about writing. Tragedy is not concerned with human justice. Tragedy is the statement of an expiation, but not the miserable expiation of a codified breach of a local arrangement organized by the knaves for the fools. The tragic figure represents the expiation of original sin, of the original and eternal sin, the sin of having been born. After just 4 terms of teaching at Trinity College, Beckett found that he was unable to go on. Despite his deep academic knowledge, he knew that the world of academia was not for him. To the consternation of his parents and his supportive colleagues, he resigned. He was now 26 years old, increasingly beset by depression, and virtually incapable of holding down any kind of job. His mother nagged, his father bluffly tried to snap him out of it. He began drinking heavily. His parents gave him some money, and he returned to Paris, where he began writing a novel. This would eventually become A Dream of Fair to Middling Women. Its protagonist is a character called Balacqua, named after the character in Dante's Divine Comedy, who is sent to purgatory for the sin of sloth. The novel is loosely based on various incidents in Beckett's life, and Balacqua is recognisably Beckett himself. It consists of several episodes interspersed with occasional intellectual meanderings. In the end, Beckett himself was forced to admit that the novel was a failure, though he would eventually salvage one section as a short story called Dante and the Lobster. In its depiction of Balacqua's physical decrepitude and mental inconsistency, this story contains the first inkling of some of the themes that would come to fruition in Beckett's later work. There is also the occasional glimpse of Beckett's grim, farcical humour, as for instance in His aunt was in the garden tending whatever flowers die at that time of year. In 1933, Beckett's father died, leaving him a small but regular income, just enough for him to live on. He began a period of several months wandering about Europe, travelling through Germany and France, living in cheap lodgings, mooching about various cities and visiting art galleries. In between times he wrote a number of short stories and poems. His letters to his friends reveal him by turns depressed and ebulliently defiant. His comments on the literary world that rejected his works would always tend to the latter. Critics were referred to as chartered recountants. The well-known London publisher Chatto & Windus became Chaton & Windup. Outwardly, he became ever more withdrawn. Beckett ended up in London, where he settled in a cheap room in Chelsea in the district appropriately known as World's End. Here he embarked upon a period of psychoanalysis, part of which involved attending, along with his psychiatrist, a lecture by Jung. During the course of the lecture, Jung explained how there is no unity to consciousness, which is capable of splitting into separate complexes, each of which can develop its own ego, to the point where they speak in voices which are like the voices of definite people. At one stage, Jung compared the mind to a series of spheres, one within the other, each becoming darker, with the darkest at the very heart of the mind, containing the personal and collective unconscious. When the mind relinquished its conscious autonomy, the unconscious grew in strength until it overcame the conscious mind. Then the individual became the victim of a new autonomous activity that does not start from his ego, but starts from the dark sphere. These interpretations would have a profound and lasting effect on Beckett, but none more so than Jung's assertion that there are certain people who suffer from the fact that they have never been really born. Beckett would continue to identify with this diagnosis until finally it became an integral element of his most profound work. Beckett later remarked, "I hated London." He felt alienated and alone. His accent marked him out as an Irishman, and consequent prejudice, while he found himself unable to relate to English literary acquaintances. Eventually, after 2 bad years, he decided it was time to pull the plug on London. He returned to Ireland to live with his mother, who, ironically, had been one of the main reasons for him going into psychoanalysis. Their relationship was too close and too difficult. Her overbearing character and utter disregard for his ambitions to become a writer left him exhausted and bewildered, yet unable, finally, to break free. In between times, Beckett continued writing poetry and short stories. In 1933, his book of short stories entitled More Pricks Than Kicks was accepted by a London publisher. This book consisted of a number of linked stories featuring Balakwa, the hero of his abandoned novel. My sometime friend Balakwa enlivened the last phase of his solipsism before he towed the line and began to relish the world with the belief that the best thing he had to do was to move constantly from place to place. He did not know how this conclusion had been gained, but that it was not thanks to his preferring one place to another, he felt sure. A year later, a friend in Paris offered to publish his collection of poems, Echoes, Bones, and Other Precipitates, as long as Beckett contributed toward the cost. The title poem in its entirety runs, "Asylum under my tread all this day, their muffled revels as the flesh falls, breaking without fear or favour wind, the cantaloupe of sense and nonsense run, taken by the maggots for what they are." Such poetry, published in a small limited edition in English, in Paris, attracted little attention. Beckett was now almost 30, and still having to live off his wits and his small private income. He settled down to have another go at writing a novel. Between writing and rewriting, this would take him 3 years to complete, finally being accepted by a London publisher in 1937. This is, recognisably, Beckett's first accomplished post-apprentice work. The author's need to inflict his great erudition upon the reader is restrained to the point where the proceedings remain more or less comprehensible. The bleak, self-defensive humour comes into its own, and the result is a work by turns farcical and philosophical. Surely the work of a truly oblique and original mind beginning to express itself with a measure of confidence rather than arrogance. Its opening words set the tone. The sun shone, having no alternative, on the nothing new. Murphy sat out of it, as though he were free, in a mew in West Brompton. Here, for what might have been 6 months, he had eaten, drunk, slept, and put his clothes on and off, in a medium-sized cage of northwestern aspect, commanding an unbroken view of medium-sized cages of southeastern aspect. Murphy is an impecunious Irish intellectual, driven to misanthropic despair as he seeks some form of spiritual relief from the world around him. We see him sitting in his room, naked and bound to a rocking chair. Only the most local movements were possible. Sweat poured off him, tightening the thongs. The breath was not perceptible. The eyes, cold and unwavering as a gull's, stared up. Murphy subjected himself to this ordeal because it gave him pleasure. First it gave his body pleasure. It appeased his body. Then it set him free in his mind. For it was not until his body was appeased that he could come alive in his mind. Murphy has affinities with many of Beckett's favourite thinkers. Like Descartes, thinking is his proof to himself of his existence, and his philosophy leads him to believe that his mind is separate from his body. He is possessed by a Schopenhauerian pessimism and views the world as a vale of Maya. And besides witty echoes of various philosophers, there are also direct references to Jung. Murphy's mind pictured itself as a large, hollow sphere, hermetically closed to the universe without. This was not an impoverishment, for it excluded nothing that it did not itself contain.
Nothing ever had been, was, or would be in the universe outside it, but was already present as virtual or actual, or virtual rising into actual, or actual falling into virtual in the universe inside it.
Despite his solipsistic inclinations, Murphy cannot avoid becoming embroiled in the outside world. In the course of the novel, we meet the prostitute Celia, who is Murphy's sole support, until he ends up in an asylum called the Magdalen Mental Mercy Seat. Here he continues his search for Nirvana, rocking in his chair, until someone inadvertently pulls the wrong chain in the lavatory, releasing gas into his room where there is a lighted candle. After the fatal explosion, we learn of Murphy's will. With regard to the disposal of these, my body, mind, and soul, I desire that they be burnt and placed in a paper bag. His ashes are then to be taken to the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, where they are to be tipped down the lavatory. And I desire that the chain be there pulled upon them, if possible, during the performance. Unfortunately, the man chosen to execute this task, his friend Cooper, gets drunk in a bar and ends up angrily throwing the paper bag containing Murphy's ashes at a man who had given him great offence. The bag bursts, scattering the ashes. By closing time, the body, mind, and soul of Murphy were freely distributed over the floor of the saloon, and before another day spring greyened, the earth had been swept away with the sand, the beer, the butts, the glass, the matches, the spits, the vomit. Unsurprisingly, the publication of such an oddity passed all but unnoticed in literary London. But the little attention it did eventually attract was significant. Dylan Thomas wrote an unfavourable review but declared, "Murphy is the individual ostrich in the mass-produced desert," characterising Beckett's humour as "Freudian blarney, Sodom and Begorra." Later, the young Anglo-Irish Iris Murdoch, more than a decade before she became a writer, found a deep rapport with Murphy's Irishness and originality. Later still, an unread copy was borrowed from a public library by the penniless actor Harold Pinter, who was so overwhelmed that he decided to steal it. Meanwhile, Beckett's life in Ireland was going from bad to worse. He was still living at home, but spent the afternoons and evenings wandering the pubs of Dublin. Warnings consisted of hangovers and motherly reprimands. He began to develop psychosomatic illnesses, suffering particularly from scrofulous rashes, anal cysts, and boils. By the autumn of 1937, illness-inflicted abstinence allowed him to pay off his accumulated pub debts, and he had enough money to travel again. He set off for Paris, determined that this time he would stay away as long as he could. Unfortunately, he was called back to Dublin to appear in a libel case, which one of his drinking companions had taken against the writer Oliver St. John Gogarty. Loyally, Beckett returned, but his public appearance in court proved traumatic. Squirming in the limelight of the witness box, Beckett was forced to endure a humiliating vilification of his character by Gogarty's counsel. Adopting an air of bluff, puritanical philistinism, the lawyer mercilessly played to the gallery. Beckett was dismissed as a pretentious intellectual, the writer of a pornographic poem, by the title of Horoscope with a capital W prefixed. Next day, a report in the Irish Times referred to Beckett as "the bored and blasphemer from Paris." He didn't dare go home and face his mother. This time Beckett left Ireland, swearing never to return.
Back in Paris, he found himself unable to concentrate on serious writing, and was pleased to take on occasional literary hack work for extra funds.
Word that he had now published a novel began to spread among his friends. He made contact with James Joyce, and through other friends was invited to one of the wild parties thrown by the American heiress, Peggy Guggenheim, who was in Paris buying up modern art for her London gallery. Guggenheim described Beckett as "a tall, lanky Irishman of about 30, with enormous green eyes that never looked at you. He wore spectacles and always seemed to be far away solving some intellectual problem. He spoke very seldom and never said anything stupid. He was excessively polite, but rather awkward. He dressed badly in tight-fitting French clothes, and had no vanity about his appearance. Guggenheim soon fell in love with Beckett, and they began an on-and-off affair that would last many months. But in the end, the vivacious, socializing Guggenheim, who collected famous names as much as she collected paintings, and the elusive, misanthropic Beckett proved incompatible, and they went their separate ways. Decades later, in her autobiography, Confessions of an Art Addict, Peggy Guggenheim would claim that among the many famous figures she had encountered, only three immediately struck her as geniuses: the surrealist Max Ernst, the sculptor Alberto Giacometti, and Samuel Beckett. This was apparently not hindsight. In her own words, when she had first met Beckett, he had been merely a frustrated writer, a pure intellectual. But despite their difficulties and their disparate attitudes, she had detected in him an exceptional creative spark, a spark that Beckett himself was far from sure he possessed at the time. Joyce, too, claimed to see this. Others believed in Beckett even when he did not believe in himself, though it would still be many years before such faith was justified. Meanwhile, the heavy drinking continued. En ballon rouge, drunk at the zinc counter of a small Paris café, cost little more than a box of matches, and Beckett would regularly end up making the rounds of the late-night cafés in Montparnasse, where he now lived. Despite his hectic nightlife, he still found time for exercise, playing occasional games of tennis with expatriate friends who invited him to a private club on the outskirts of Paris. For mixed doubles, he was occasionally partnered by a talented French pianist called Suzanne de Chevaux-Dumenil. It was also at this time that Beckett formed a close friendship with a Swiss-Italian sculptor, Alberto Giacometti, who shared Beckett's solitariness, fondness for late-night bars, and sardonic view of the world. The two insomniacs would share long, understanding silences at the bar, pondering the evils of the world between draining their glasses. Giacometti had an unabashed penchant for prostitutes, and Beckett appears to have joined him in this pursuit as well as exploring the field on his own. Almost certainly, as a result of this, Beckett became involved in an incident in Montparnasse late one night in January 1938. In the course of an argument with a pimp who appeared to know him and wanted to borrow some money, Beckett was stabbed in the chest. He fell to the ground and was quickly rushed to the hospital. Here it was found that the knife blade had barely missed his heart and lung. He was lucky to be alive. Beckett had long been prone to hypochondria, but now that the affliction was both genuine and serious, he behaved stoically. When news of Beckett's injury reached Dublin, his mother and brother immediately set off on the quickest route to Paris, which in those days involved a gruelling 24 hours of continuous travelling, including 2 ferry crossings and 3 rail journeys. Beckett was deeply moved by his mother's evident concern, and they appear to have effected an awkward reconciliation. The events had a deep effect upon Beckett, and even broke his writer's block. In his hospital bed he found himself writing poetry again. Another hospital visitor was Beckett's tennis partner, Suzanne. Although she was 38 and thus 6 years older than Beckett, it quickly became clear that she was attracted to him. When Beckett left the hospital, they began going out together. They made an unlikely couple. He drank, she did not. He lived a bohemian life, she preferred lace-making. But they quickly discovered a mutual interest in classical music and the arts. In time, they became lovers. Unlike Peggy Guggenheim, however, Suzanne appeared to have a more calming effect on Beckett. As Peggy Guggenheim cattily remarked about Suzanne, "She made curtains while I made scenes." In the summer of 1939, Beckett received the royalties he was due from the publication of Murphy and travelled to Ireland to see his mother. During the visit, Britain and France declared war on Germany, plunging Europe into World War II. Ireland remained neutral, but to the consternation of his mother, Beckett insisted upon returning to Paris, telling her, "I promised so many friends that I would be back." By now, Beckett and Suzanne were living together in a small flat on the Rue des Favorites, a grim, featureless street south of Montparnasse. In the spring of 1940, the Germans invaded France, quickly approaching Paris. Beckett and Suzanne fled with thousands of refugees who headed south, but eventually made their way back to German-occupied Paris. Beckett had no wish to return to Ireland, and Suzanne was equally reluctant to return to live with her parents in provincial Troyes. Back in Paris, Beckett soon joined a resistance network. With characteristic diffidence and more than a little truth, he later characterized his actions as Boy Scout stuff. But there is no doubting the fact that this involved real danger. After the war, Beckett would be awarded the Croix de Guerre for his efforts, though he typically omitted to tell anyone of this for many years. In 1942, the Germans penetrated the resistance cell with which Beckett was involved. He and Suzanne immediately left the Rue des Favorites and went on the run. After being put up at various secret addresses in Paris, they set off south with false papers for unoccupied Vichy, France, which was run by Pétain's collaborationist government. For days they tramped the roads, sometimes in despair, often bickering in their extremity. Elements of this dialogue would later surface in the absurd exchanges between Vladimir and Estragon in Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Estragon: I can't go on like this. Vladimir: That's what you think. Vladimir: Well, shall we go? Estragon: Yes, let's go. They do not move. Eventually, Beckett and Suzanne reached the remote village of Roussillon in the craggy hills above the Rhône Delta, some 400 miles south of Paris. Here they hid out for the remainder of the war, doing occasional farm work to help pay for their keep. Beckett would sometimes join the local Maquis, resistance, on armed night patrols. These were largely futile exercises involving 20-mile hikes across rugged heathland, intended to bolster morale. Beckett soon fell into deep dejection, but attempted to keep up his spirits by beginning a novel which would eventually be called What, his first sustained creative work in more than 5 years. What would mark a break from Beckett's previous work. Gone is the self-conscious intellectualism, the tendency to pretentious superiority. In its place comes a distinctly neurotic sense of futility, as Beckett attempts to explore and embody various philosophical questions in concrete form. This is achieved by what would become a distinctly Beckett-like form of reductionism, which, besides reducing the narrative to its bare bones, also involves a reductio ad absurdum of the entire novelistic genre. In one sense, Watt marks a serious deepening of Beckett's psychological affinities. Previously, Murphy had shown deep empathy with the schizophrenics in the Mercy Seat Asylum. In the case of Watt, the eponymous hero unmistakably is schizophrenic, both in his actions and in the obsessive way in which his story is recounted. We are introduced to Watt in slapstick fashion. Watt bumped into a porter wheeling a milk can. Watt fell and his hat and bags were scattered. The porter did not fall, but he let go his can, which fell back with a thump on its tilted rim, rocked, rattling on its base, and finally came to a stand. This was a happy chance, for had it fallen on its side... In basic outline, the story has a symbolic, distinctly Kafkaesque simplicity. After a series of tragi-farcical mishaps, the bedraggled Watt turns up at the house of Mr. Knott, where he is to work as a servant. After being subjected to a seemingly endless diatribe by the departing servant he is replacing, Watt takes up his duties on the ground floor, performing his allotted menial tasks. Eventually he graduates to the top of the house, where he looks after the bedroom, taking the place of Erskine, whose employment has come to an end. During this time in the house, Watt's life revolves around the mysterious but elusive Mr. Knott, the master of the house. Mr. Knott saw nobody, heard from nobody, as far as Watt could see. But Watt was not so foolish as to draw any conclusion from this. The latter observation is the key to Watt's overriding philosophical attitude toward the world. Watt catches a few glimpses of Mr. Knott, the most notable being of him meditating in the garden. Otherwise, Mr. Knott remains unknown, seemingly defined only by negation. The narrative of the story is characterized by neurotic obsession with detail and repetition. This comes across as perverse, psychotic, or humorous, depending upon one's attitude toward the repetitive goings-on in which Watt becomes involved. At first these appear trivial to the point of tediousness, but they soon open up into a world of deeper meaning. What distressed Watt in this incident, and in subsequent similar incidents, was not so much that he did not know what had happened, for he did not care what had happened, as that nothing had happened, that a thing that was nothing had happened, with the utmost formal distinctness, and that it continued to happen in his mind, he supposed, though he did not know exactly what that meant, and though it seemed to be outside him, before him, about him, and so on. This may appear as a distinctly obsessive and oblique examination of the nature of existence, but there is no doubting its philosophical penetration. Such passages do not make for easy reading, and indeed there are times when it is almost impossible to continue without one's mind drifting into something akin to involuntary schizophrenia. Yet there is no denying the depth of the philosophical insights achieved in such passages. No other writer had entered into such territory in quite such a manner before. This is the opposite of the Joycean manner which had previously so swamped Beckett. Instead of vast proliferations of meaning, there is instead a stripping away of experience to a basic bedrock of meaning. What may have appeared like a form of madness, just as Beckett himself may have been on the verge of complete breakdown, but he knew what he was doing. This was no inadvertent expression of human extremity and futility. It was instead a conscious investigation of the futility of the human condition in its most fundamental aspects. What it expressed was precisely how Beckett felt at the time, and mirroring such mental disintegration proved a feat of existential revelation. What occupies the hinterland where art shades into philosophy? The practice of one becomes the practice of the other. The deeper resonances are left for us to ponder. The surface ones are more easily discernible. There are evident indications that Mr. Knott is intended as a negation. Knott. Unravelably knotted. A negative version of God. Watt undergoes his quotidian and endlessly repetitive fate, at first with extreme attention and later with some vexation. And the results on the whole were meagre. He poses a question. What? By his very existence. Though it is worth noting here that he is not called why. His function is epistemological rather than causal. He examines and questions the world in which he finds himself, but despite the obvious symbolic references in these names, Beckett insists at the end, no symbols where none intended. We are given the pointers. The rest we are left free to ponder upon, work out for ourselves, or simply ignore, depending upon our temperament. Much as in life. In this way, Watt may be viewed as anything from a trite comedy to an inscrutable farce, though the profundity of one's reaction should by no means be taken as a reflection of character. In August 1944, Roussillon was liberated by American troops, but it was a full 8 months before Beckett and Suzanne managed to get back to Paris. They discovered, much to their relief, that the flat in Rue des Favorites had not been ransacked in their absence, a fate that had befallen many other such abandoned properties. From here, Beckett set out for Ireland. Passing through London, he called in at his publisher's to discover that Murphy had long since been forgotten, and the accumulated royalties he had been hoping to collect were non-existent. He handed over the manuscript of Watt. On his return to Dublin, Beckett found that his mother had aged considerably in the 6 years since he had last seen her. The tall, proud woman he had known and fought was now a bowed old lady who looked all of her 74 years. Beckett, for his part, looked emaciated, his face gaunt with suffering. His teeth were in a rotten state, and he was suffering once more from his perennial boils. Much of his time was spent visiting the dentist and consulting the family doctor. In the midst of this, a letter arrived from his publisher in which the editor gave his reaction to Watt, expressing his very mixed feelings about it and considerable bewilderment. To be quite frank, it is too wild and unintelligible for the most part to stand any chance of successful publication over here at the present time. True originality is seldom acceptable, but its rejection only added further to Beckett's gloom. Then a further blow struck. To his consternation, Beckett now found his way back to Paris blocked by post-war travel restrictions.
After desperate inquiries, he managed to find a position as an interpreter for the Irish Red Cross, which was sending a mission to set up a hospital at Saint-Lô in Normandy.
Beckett arrived to find that the town had been reduced to rubble during the D-Day landings a year previously, and nothing had changed since. As ever, Beckett responded to the real suffering he encountered here with genuine dedication. When his tour of duty was over, he returned to Paris. He was now coming up to 40 years old, with failure staring him in the face. He had no idea what to do. Since writing was the only thing he could do, he began scribbling a few disconnected pieces. By way of a change, he tried writing them in French. Then the money ran out, and he was forced to return to Dublin. Post-war currency restrictions meant that his small private income could not be sent abroad. Once back in Dublin, to the consternation of his mother and brother, he began drinking heavily again, wandering the night streets in a state of profound despair. It was on one of these nights that he found himself standing on the end of the stone pier at Dunleary Harbour, where he experienced his revelation amidst the howling of the wind and the breaking of the waves, realizing the folly of all that he had previously attempted. "I became aware of my stupidity." All the while he had striven to be knowing, to impart knowledge of one kind or another. His early writings had been swamped by this intellectual knowingness, yet even his later writings had attempted to come to terms with the world, imparting some philosophical apprehension of it. But this had been his big mistake. Instead of trying to write about the outer world, he should have been concentrating on what he really felt. He should have been concentrating on what he alone knew, his own feelings, the darkness of his inner world, filled with the uncertainty and hopelessness that constantly dogged him. It was not knowledge he should have been striving to impart, but ignorance. This was his true material, what he had been ignoring all along, the darkness of his own mind. Realizing this, and achieving it, were not the same thing. Beckett returned to Paris and began trying to put into practice what he had fleetingly understood. He found that writing in French gave him a certain freedom, allowing him to shed all the intellectual fluency that came so easily to him in English. Here he found a basic style, a simple syntax and unadorned language which utterly suited his purpose. But how to use this language? He started into a novel about two knockabout Irish characters called Mercier and Camier, Huguenot names like his own. He described their inept blundering from inconsequential disaster to drunken farce, with much hilarious deadpan dialogue in between. Here was the hopelessness he had been looking for, but still something was not quite right. There now began the period of Beckett's life which he referred to as the siege in the room.
This would last from 1946 until 1948, during which he would produce his finest work.
It was spent largely in his room, isolated from the world, coming face to face with his own demons, attempting to explore the workings of his mind. His routine was, for the most part, simple enough. He would rise around the early hours of the afternoon, make himself scrambled eggs, and retire to his room for as many hours as he could bear. He would then leave for his late-night perambulation of the bars of Montparnasse, drinking copious amounts of cheap red wine, returning before dawn and a long attempt to sleep. His entire life revolved around his almost psychotic obsession to write. The writing itself was psychologically painful in the extreme, and to begin with did not go according to plan. In despair he attempted to write a long, complex, three-act play called Eleutheria, the Greek for freedom. The play recounted the attempts of a young man called Victor Crabbe to break free from his middle-class family. The hero's name was indicative of Beckett's self-esteem during this period. The action of the play took place on a stage divided into a bourgeois living room and Victor's bear room, and involved a variety of characters with names such as Skunk, Puke, Puke, and Mech. Mech is French for pimp. But this proved no good, and he set it aside. Though he didn't realize it at the time, both the names and the embryonic characters to which they were attached would continue to grow in his mind, reappearing years later in all their mature idiosyncrasy. Next he tried a number of long, short stories, and in the course of these he discovered the solution to his problem. To reach the truth of his inner experience, he needed to write in monologue. He started into a novel. "I am in my mother's room. It's I who live there now. I don't know how I got there. Perhaps in an ambulance, certainly a vehicle of some kind. I was helped. I'd never have got there alone. There's this man who comes every week. Perhaps I got here thanks to him. He says not." Beckett had found his tone of voice and his situation. A bereft character in isolation, left to the ramblings of his mind. Here was the human condition at its most fundamental. Beckett had in fact already come very close to this in Watt, where he had been aware philosophically of what he was trying to achieve, but had allowed the literary element to elude his grasp. The voice had not been there. But now that he had it, he refused to let go of it. Here was the freedom to wander and explore the oddities and absurdities of the human mind, the ebb and flow of thought, the sudden diversions of verbal consciousness. Here Molloy reflects on seeing a nameless character he seems to have known. All that inner space one never sees, the brain and heart and other caverns where thought and feeling dance their Sabbath. He looks old, and it is a sorry sight to see him solitary after so many years, so many days and nights unthinkingly given to that rumour rising at birth and even earlier. What shall I do? What shall I do? Now low, a murmur, now precise as the head waiter's, and to follow, and often rising to a scream, and in the end, or almost, to be abroad alone by unknown ways in the gathering night with a stick. Such prose may be difficult to follow, but often gives up its meaning on a second reading if one ponders the context and jumps of Molloy's thought processes, such as they are. The voice has its own momentum, following the breathing of the narrator. In this voice, Beckett had found the freedom to include meditation, poetry, philosophical musings, all filtered through the wry, hard-bitten humour of his own vision. There was no plot, only the occasional rambling story or memory. The reader, like the writer, was expected to immerse himself in the meandering voice of consciousness. This was not easy, but once achieved, was immensely rewarding, by turns entertaining, hilarious, insightful. In this apparent absence of life, all human life was there. Unexpectedly, in the second half of the book, Beckett reverts to the voice of a more recognisably orthodox consciousness. This is Moran, who impinges on the tale of Molloy from his own objective viewpoint. Moran is all that Molloy is not, though in many ways they are the opposite sides of the same coin. Between them they may be said to complete the circle of humanity. Unlike Molloy, Moran believes in willpower, action, and reason. He is a fanatic of habit, a domestic tyrant obsessed with control. In place of the anarchy of Molloy's mind, we encounter paranoia, sadism, and fixation. Both Molloy and Moran are deranged, but in their own separate ways. To revert to Freudian terms, Molloy is sinking into his unconscious, while Moran is drawn toward his superego. Moran's mission is to find Molloy. His voice is a hilarious parody of ordered consciousness. Should I set out on my autocycle? This was the question with which I began. I had a methodical mind, and never set out on a mission without prolonged reflection as to the best way of setting out. It was the first problem to solve at the outset of each inquiry, and I never moved until I had solved it to my satisfaction. Sometimes I took my autocycle, sometimes the train, sometimes the motor coach, just as sometimes, too, I left on foot or on my bicycle, silently, in the night.